Good morning, everyone. Monday, August 10th, the start of another week of war, global war. To cover the events of this war, NBC staff reporters are at their posts in every important news center the world over. Now, we will hear direct from some of these reporters. First, from Grant Parr in Cairo.
Hello, New York. This is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. With the Luftwaffe again active after several days, virtual absence from battle area skies, there have been air crashes around Alamein during the past 3 days. The tempo of this air activity has stepped up a bit during each succeeding day. On the offensive side, United States Air Force bombers took the war deep into enemy territory yesterday, arriving just at dawn over Benghazi Harbor, some 600 airline miles west of the front. Our big bombers cut loose tons of explosives on the moles and the shipping moored around them. One ship was hit, and others either hit or damaged by bombs which fell among them. This was the first raid on Benghazi in several weeks, largely because the enemy has been putting most of his supplies into Tobruk or Marsa Matru, many miles nearer the front. But these ports have been bombed almost nightly by either American or British raiders, and Rommel apparently tried to make a little more use of Benghazi. Those 300 extra miles of road from Tobruk to Benghazi mean a great deal if you have to haul supplies all the way by truck. Yet to bombers such as the American B-24s or B-17s, that mileage means nothing. In fact, as the Liberator flies, the distance is only 240 miles. Here is concrete proof that when observers and RAF officers said months ago that what this theater needed most was more heavy bombers, they were dead right. There was a time when a port as far removed from the front as Benghazi might have been comparatively safe, but not anymore. American-built Liberators and flying fortresses and the big British Halifaxes can take care of Benghazi and point further afield any day or night of the year. Yesterday and the night before, Royal Air Force light and medium bombers were raiding enemy airfields around Daba. Later yesterday, British fighters followed up and strafed these most forward enemy drones. Although exact figures are not yet available, it's certain that large numbers of grounded Axis fighters were destroyed. In one previous series of attacks, the RAF destroyed scores of enemy machines on these fields and for a time almost made them useless to the enemy. With the successful bombing of an Axis motor lighter off Bardia yesterday, plus the American success at Benghazi, the 15-day air attack score for Axis vessels reached 44 sunk or badly damaged. And I return you to New York.
Next to Britain's capital, where our reporter is John McVane. Go ahead, London.
This is London. The RAF last night sent a strong force of bombers to Osnabrück and other points in northwestern Germany. The raid is said to have been very successful. Attacks were also made on the Le Havre docks and airfields in the Low Countries. Six bombers are missing. Osnabrück is an important communications center and has a copper works and two steel works, all making munitions. The Germans lost three bombers over Britain in scattered raids. Dispatches reaching London from India today say that more rioting broke out in Bombay this morning. Police fired on a big crowd, trains were stoned, and work in 18 mills in the Bombay area has been disrupted. Police are patrolling the area of yesterday's outbreaks. There's some talk in London today of recalling Parliament to discuss the India situation, but no definite decision has yet been taken. Labour members are anxious that Parliament should have the opportunity of fully examining the government's action. General opinion fully supports what the government has done, and there's no sign of any yielding. But some members of Parliament feel that the tactical move of arresting Gandhi and the Congress leaders should have been delayed a little while longer. Liberal observers believe that if the British authorities had shown a little more imagination, and if Congress had been a little more ready to see reason over the past few years, the outright clash might never have come. But the British policy toward India drifted along until it became too late to bridge the gap between the Indian government and the embittered Congress leaders. Today, the trade union organ, the London Daily Herald, calls Gandhi's policies the acme of unreason, and asserts that his conduct and statements have done more harm than good in India. But the Herald thinks that the arrests will make martyrs of Gandhi and the others. The paper thinks that imprisoning them so quickly after the Congress meeting is an evidence of weakness, and the Herald calls for Parliament to meet and hear an explanation of the government's policy. The authoritative London Times calls the arrest a bitter necessity. It says British policy must aim to do two things: defend India and resist any attempt by any group in India to paralyze that defense. And secondly, build up the structure of Indian unity and freedom. The Times says, whatever errors may have been committed in the past, Great Britain is today freely offering to India that freedom which can only come through unity. It is the misguided leaders of the Congress Party whose policy perpetuates division. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Our roundup continues now as we take you to the Southwest Pacific, to Martin Agransky reporting from somewhere in Australia.
This is Martin Agransky, somewhere in Australia. Our Air Force yesterday and last night continued to support the main attack on the Solomon by all-out air raids on the Japs' main aerial support base of Rabaul in New Britain, lying just to the northwest of the Solomon. Other heavy raids carried out against the Jap drones that lay in New Guinea and at Gazmata in New Britain with heavy demolition bombs indicate that the function of our forces in this theater is purely to harass the enemy's rear aerial supply bases with the intention of preventing Jap aerial reinforcements from reaching the Solomon. Only two concrete facts are available on the Solomon's battle from this headquarters. The first is that the enemy opposition seems still far from overcome. The second is that the excessive Jap claims of damages inflicted on our forces are, I quote, monstrously exaggerated, unquote. I can add to one other relative comment made to me today by an authoritative observer. But, I quote again, in this battle we have not sent a boy to do a man's job, unquote. To any of you at home whose memories carry as far back as the Midway battle, where the Japs attacked our land-based forces, the difficulty of our position on the Solomon's attack should be readily apparent. As at Midway, where the Jap was the attacker, so in the Solomon's, where we are the attackers, the advantage rests with the land-based forces. Planes operating from land air drones can be faster and carry much heavier loads than planes operating from aircraft carriers. Also, losses to land-based squadrons are much more easily replaced than the same losses suffered by carrier-based aircraft. You can be certain that our commanders knew the risks they faced in a seaborne invasion, and any armchair critic who raises his voice about the apparent slowness of the operations would do well to remember these often proved risks. If we are successful in the Solomon, we will have been successful in an operation which an extremely powerful Jap force made a miserable failure of at Midway. Strategically, a successful landing on the Solomons will considerably relieve the Jap pressure against Port Moresby and northeast Australia. It can, of course, only be a starting point for an island-to-island offensive whose next logical objective would seem to be points north. What competent observers here are not forgetting is that this offensive was not initiated from this command, and that while its success may better our strategic position here, it will work no magic on increasing our not-too-great strength on this front. This is Martin Agransky signing off now from somewhere in Australia.
Events on the domestic front are reported by Richard Harkness of the Philadelphia Inquirer. We take you to Washington.
Washington has scant official information this morning on the big battle in the Pacific. The Navy gives us only this. The United States' great sea, air, and possibly land offensive still rages. Our forces are meeting stiff resistance. It's still too early to count losses, either our losses or Japan's. That is all the Navy has to say this morning about the death struggle for the Solomon Islands. But military men supply us with background information, information important in weighing future developments. The battle in the Southwest, around the Solomons, is the United Nations' first all-out offensive since Pearl Harbor. It's the first time we've picked the time and place of battle. The battles of the Coral Sea and Midway were American victories, all right, but they were defensive victories. Now it's the Americans who are doing the hitting, and it's the Japs who are on the defensive. Then, some military experts here attach so much importance to the Solomon Islands engagement that they're already calling the Southwest Pacific a second front. application of the term seems logical. Certainly, our action gives at least indirect aid to Russia. Japan's been poised for weeks to jump on Russia's back in Siberia. Now, the Japanese have their bloody hands full in the Pacific. So the Navy's bombardment of Kiska takes on military significance. The shelling hit Japanese ships and shore installations, shore bases the Japs had been building up for weeks to operate their submarines and planes. Apparently, the Navy's action against Kiska is over. Of course, we can't hope to dispose of the Japs there in a single bombardment, but the shelling was the most vigorous action our Navy's surface forces have taken to date against the invaders in the Aleutians. Until this attack, we had been merely nibbling at the enemy with planes and submarines, but the nibbles amount to a sizable bite when added up. For these attacks cost the Japanese 7 destroyers and an unannounced total of cargo ships and transports. Those of us who thought that it can't happen here, that the Nazis would never bomb our East Coast, have another think coming today. Maybe the Germans weren't coming over this afternoon or tomorrow, but the Nazis did have their spies ready to guide them straight to airplane bases and factories on the Atlantic seaboard. We know an enemy attack was planned from the air, because American flyers have discovered ingenious guideposts to vital defense centers. In one instance, a spy placed sacks of grain in the field in the form of a figure 9, with the tail of the 9 pointing to an aircraft plant. In another instance, a field had been so plowed that the fallow part, clearly seen from the air, formed an arrow toward another plane plant close by. Washington is filled with uniforms these days, American, British, Canadian, Yugoslavian, Chinese, and others. But there's only one man, a stout-hearted lad who dares wear his kilts. He was walking up Connecticut Avenue the other day, the plaid swirling around his knees. He tried to be oblivious to the little group of street urchins who trailed along behind. But he lost his aplomb when one of the boys ran in front of him to get a better view. Look, he shouted at his friends, she has a mustache. And that's all from Washington.
News of the fighting along the important Russian front is reported now by Robert Magadoff from Moscow.
Robert Magadoff speaking from Moscow. General Bradley's mission is proceeding at top speed. He has already had 4 meetings with the representatives of the Commissariat for Defense. And these meetings, General Bradley said to the press this morning, are conducted in a spirit of greatest cooperation and sincere friendship. The general, however, has not yet delivered President Roosevelt's letter to Joseph Stalin. The Soviet leader said Mr. Bradley has been notified of the letter, and the general will deliver it as soon as Stalin is ready to receive him. General Bradley's meetings with the Soviet military are not regular, and are called by the Americans or the Russians at any time of day or night. Yesterday, for instance, General Bradley received what he termed as hot news and summoned a meeting after midnight. The general emphasized once more that his mission deals purely with questions of intensifying the arrival of American supplies and has nothing to do with the problem of a second front. The Soviet press, in the meantime, has been carrying for about 2 weeks now daily reports of mass meetings and newspaper comment in the United States and Great Britain urging the immediate opening of a second front in Europe. The Russian people are thinking about the second front as much as about the military situation in the Soviet South. To them, it's a matter of crucial importance. This is why so many Russians, speaking privately, assert that the launching of a second front or the failure to launch one will be the supreme test proving whether or not their allies are real partners in this world war. Besides, pointing to the situation in Northern Caucasus, they say that it is suicidal, especially for Great Britain, not to divert part of German strength on the Eastern Front with the utmost urgency and speed.
These were the reports of Grant Parr from Cairo, John McBain from London, Richard Harkness from Washington, Martin Agronsky from Australia, and Robert Magadoff from Moscow. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Good evening, everyone. This is John W. Vandercook speaking for Alka-Seltzer, bringing you the news of the world. The U.S. Navy has reported that American Marines, in the face of fierce Japanese resistance, have now made a landing in the southeast Solomon Islands, somewhere in the Tulagi area. Hard fighting continues, and our Navy concedes the loss in that three-day-old struggle of one of our cruisers sunk and of two cruisers, two destroyers, and a troop transport damaged. It is important to note that that Navy statement seems to dispose of earlier Japanese claims of much greater American and Allied naval losses. Moscow today admits the deliberate destruction by the Red Army by fire and explosives of the secondary Caucasus oil fields near Mayakop. Mayakop, in an average year, produces 2 million tons of precious oil, and the Nazi invaders are believed almost within sight of the blazing ruin which the Soviet defenders have now made of Mayakop's storage tanks and black forest of oil derricks. On the two fronts below endangered Stalingrad, however, the Red Armies are reported standing firm. And now a word from Charles Lyon.
Here's something that may help on that job sometime this week. Get a package of Alka-Seltzer tablets and keep it handy. Keep Alka-Seltzer handy for those times a headache or a touch of nervous indigestion threatens to slow you down for a while. Common ailments like these are seldom serious, but that they can affect your doing your best work is a fact pretty hard to deny. Alka-Seltzer is easy to take, pleasant to taste, and it is not a laxative. And it can help you feel better fast. So make it a practice to keep Alka-Seltzer at work as well as at home. Get it at any drugstore. And now, the news of the world.
The official statement of the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Fleet, Admiral King, in Washington this afternoon, on the bare fact and the progress thus far of the great battle for the Solomon Islands, is couched in very straightforward language. Admiral King is a fighting man and not a peddler of happy headlines. He states soberly that offensive operations under the direct command of Vice Admiral Gormley, who has till now been stationed in New Zealand, have been going on now for 3 days in the southern Solomons. Admiral King states our objective frankly. The first major American offensive of this war has for its purpose the driving out of the Japs of all of their stolen nests in that humid, distant, and beautiful corner of the South Sea Islands. If that end is not achieved, then that campaign will have failed. Admiral King does not think we will fail. In spite of furious Jap resistance, U.S. Marines with other Allied troops have landed at least one point, and there is hard fighting ashore. But our naval commander, while reminding us that all our previous operations in the Pacific, however successful, have been essentially defensive and therefore not worth too many cheers, adds this warning. It should be understood that the operation now underway is one of the most difficult and complicated in warfare. Considerable losses, such as are inherent in any offensive operation, must be expected. That is straight talk, and therefore winning talk. Our job in the Solomons is a hard one, one that is wholly different from the task the Japs had when they first occupied the strategic points in that green and mountainous archipelago, which is many hundred miles east of New Guinea. The Solomons, which were given that name by a nature-faking Spanish explorer of the 16th century, who claimed, though he knew better, that the gold for Solomon's temple came from them, have a population of around 90,000 dark-skinned, stocky natives of many languages and customs. But those islands, which have had outside government for less than 50 years, never had more than 500 white residents. They were widely scattered on small, remote plantations. Less than 50 of them ever lived on the small, exquisitely lovely, separate island of Tulagi, which was the capital. So the Solomons, without regular resident troops or a single airfield, were practically undefended when the Japs came. But they came looking for trouble as an army with powerful equipment for defense. It is that powerful defensive war machinery of a kind which was never seen before in those quiet islands, which is now in operation against us. So plainly, the task which the Japs had at the beginning was very different from the one which we have now. There were dramatic developments in far-off India over the weekend, following the arrest of the leaders of the Congress Party. For a direct report, we shall hear now from Darrell Bennigan, United Press correspondent in New Delhi.
This is Darrell Bennigan calling NBC from Delhi. The movement Gandhi threatened to let loose in India started Sunday with the news of the arrest of the Mahatma and his followers. In incidents have occurred in many of the principal cities of the country, and in Bombay and Pune, shooting has been resorted to by the police. In other cities where feeling is not so high, the police have been able to disperse the crowd by charging them with the long bamboo poles called lassis or with tear smoke. In Delhi, the movement has remained nonviolent, with only a few incidents in New Delhi, and demonstrators sneaked through police cordons and staged the demonstration on Connaught Circus, a park in the center of the city a few blocks from the American barracks. The crowds were uglier yesterday, Monday, than on Sunday. A few stones were thrown in the Capitol, but the police dispersed the crowds without any trouble developing. Demonstrators in New Delhi were mainly young students full of the fire of revolution. I drove over to Old Delhi twice yesterday to watch demonstrations for the release of Gandhi and his followers. The procession was on in the morning, and an ugly crowd surrounded me shouting, "Get out of India!" And the recently disinterred cry of Inqilab Zindabad, "Long live revolution." The fact that I was an American seemed to lessen the anger in the faces of the demonstrators, but not nearly enough for my comfort. A single cry of "Get out, U.S. government," met with the Indian equivalent of a boo, a chorus of ahs. Last night, demonstrators gathered again on the grass of the so-called Gandhi ground here in Old Delhi. Several thousand people in Gandhi caps and native clothing squatted on the ground, shouted slogans, and listened to speeches by volunteers. Police were at street corners, and some even entered the ground, but there were no incidents. Similar demonstrations are going on in many Indian cities today. Their headless nature, the Congress leaders all being in jail, may make for violence, and hooliganism is bound to break out. Congress followers here, mainly students, are trying to lead the people, but finding it a hard job to control the mob once it is formed. The police are arresting the leaders as they arrive. Although Congress followers claim new leaders will arrive with everyone arrested, British observers believe that the leaderless mob, wasting its energies in processions that have no definite end, will finally disperse and the movement collapse.
Okay, New Delhi, and thanks for so excellent an eyewitness report straight from the scene of action. And next to Upton Close, who is in the newsroom in Hollywood.
While we wait for a decision in this latest battle of the Pacific, the Chinese are chiefly concerned over what will prove to be the result of the tragic dissension in India upon their situation. Already strikes and shutdowns are occurring in several of the Indian industries which have been supplying some material for air transport over the Himalayas to China. But more than that, the Chinese leaders are worried over the picture of one of the champions of democracy and freedom having to fight its own subjects while it fights the avowed enemies of democracy. This is a tremendous bolster to the propaganda of the Japanese, who are intensifying their program of Asia for Asiatics and their hypocritical pretense that they are out to establish Asiatic liberties. The Japanese are as frankly delighted over British Colonial Secretary Amory's decision to jump the gun on Gandhi as are the Chinese chagrined over that same decision. The Chinese counted, at least, on a talking period, in which the proposition of a United Nations guarantee to Indian nationalists might have gained headway. Now the Chinese are trying to guess whether the Japanese will throw all of their forces against India as soon as the rains cease, relieving China at least to some degree of immediate military pressure, or whether the Japanese will not take the much more shrewd line of letting India stew in her own juice while throwing everything they have in the way of first-class air force and veteran armies against China itself. Regarding this, the Chinese are not so worried about their ability to resist ground force attack as they are worried about our brave little United States Air Force in China that has been punishing the Japanese far beyond what the Japanese can afford to take. The Chinese are exceedingly apprehensive that if Japan should decide that she has now nothing whatever to fear in Asia, save the American Air Force in China, and should concentrate everything she's got to annihilate that Air Force, that we might not be able now to get reserves to General Chenault quick enough to save that Air Force, particularly since those reserves seem to have to go in through India. That is the thing that is particularly worrying the leaders in China at this moment. And now, after 10 seconds, we'll hear from Earl Godwin in Washington.
Good evening, folks. I'm sorry to relate to you that Washington today reminds me of nothing so much as a back fence with a lot of yowling tomcats. Everybody seems to be tuning up. Take the Tolan Committee of the House, for instance. Tolan Committee has been examining what they call national defense migration. It uncorks a squawk that could be heard from here to Upton Close, and maybe has been heard there by now, in which this congressional committee, headed by Representative Tolan from out there in California, says that the war production effort lags and that no responsible official, civil or military, has shown the slightest intention of demanding the maximum output, nor is there any coordinated effort to get such output. All of which will surprise several folks, including President Roosevelt, who has coordinated the output business in the War Production Board, or at least he thought so. However, the War Production Board has been uncorking a squawk or two of its own. Said recently, the Army had failed to give any advance notice of war plants shutting down suddenly. But the Army keeps records, and how? No sooner had the WPB complained than the Army up with a copy of a letter showing that General Somerville had warned the WPB that 96 munitions plants would shut down cold unless somebody got in some material to work on. And half the town is three-cheersing for Shipmaster Kaiser's gumption in striving to go ahead and build a fleet of huge cargo planes in his own shipyards. But the Navy is not quite sure that ought to be done. Then Senator Josh Lee of Oklahoma, however, is dead certain it ought to be done, and being a senator on an important committee, he comes out today with a three-point program to boost planes for carrying cargo that will otherwise be a prey to submarines. Josh Lee calls for the greater use of plywood, immediate priorities for such planes, and a terrific building program. Alaska's congressional delegate Diamond demands a first front on the Aleutian Islands today to drive the Japs off our continent. Said a first front there is more important than a second front somewhere else. And the government froze this year's entire crop of prunes, apricots, dried apples, peaches, pears, and grapes. The Army gets first whack. The president elevated more than 100 generals to high rank today, but there remained one man to enlist an apprentice seaman in the Coast Guard. John Jessup Sherman, 17 years old, has a cousin in the Army, a cousin in the Marines. His father is the Navy Admiral F.C. Sherman of the aircraft Lexington. Is there any other family thus represented in the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard? And that's all from Washington at this time.
We'll hear some more late news from John W. Vandercook right after this 42-second message on economy. I mean the economy of keeping Alka-Seltzer in the medicine cabinet all the time. Because Alka-Seltzer is one product that offers relief in many different common ailments, we believe you'll find it an economy. You take Alka-Seltzer for prompt relief of headaches, simple neuralgia, muscular aches and pains, and the ache-all-over feeling of a cold. And it offers pleasant, speedy relief in heartburn, sour, upset stomach, and occasional acid indigestion. So, first, for the comfort it can give, and second, for its economy, keep Alka-Seltzer handy all the time. Now, back to the newsroom.
Vichy, France, a new outbreak of Nazi homicidal dementia, of the kind which always grows worse when the patient is badly worried, has just been reported from Paris. No less than 93 alleged French terrorists have been butchered by the Germans in reprisal for an undescribed but apparently serious act against the German occupation troops. And that's the news of the world. This is John W. Vandercook speaking for Alka-Seltzer and bringing you this further news. The U.S. Army Signal Corps, one of the most exciting and useful branches of the service, needs trained radio and communications men for prompt enlistment. But others who are not so trained can be trained by Uncle Sam. And so, goodbye until tomorrow from the newsroom in New York.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.